My involvement with migrants and refugee groups in the United States started when I was a student. I was completing a master's degree in applied anthropology at the time. It was the 1990s, and I was invited to a presentation by a Guatemalan community worker about his work on what was called the orchard. The orchard was a citrus tree plantation near Tucson, Arizona, where migrants arrive upon crossing the desert. It started with that presentation, followed by with a visit to the orchard, where I was able to witness the terrible condition in which those individuals arrived. Raggedy, shoeless individuals with blistered feet, sunburned, and with obvious signs of dehydration. Psychologically decompensated and in need of immediate assistance. But the only assistance they had at the time was the solidarity of other migrants organized to receive and accompany these new arrivals. I didn't know at the time, but that was my initial connection to one of the many Mayan communities under international networks of solidarity that at the time were starting to flourish throughout the United States. I became friends with some of them and subsequently collaborated in formally organizing a community association that continues serving them to this day. In addition to meaningful friendships, that connection led me to complete a study on the mental health of Mayan immigrants in the United States. That was my master's thesis. That study documented the reasons that made them flee the country, to flee Guatemala, their hazardous journeys, their life in a new reality, the reality of the United States, that brought safety, but many heartbreaks to them. That study also helped me to uncover the extraordinary levels of resilience and resourcefulness that have helped those individuals overcome the oppressing conditions in which they have lived, the traumas of being war targets, and the many obstacles they have faced in their new lives. Right after I graduated, I came to live in El Paso and began working in a women's center that served mostly immigrant women. And there I developed a relationship with an extensive group of women religious. These women were of a variety of congregations and were serving in various ministries throughout the El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, and southern New Mexico region. These women were very, very active in social justice issues. And one of them shared an invitation with me to become a visitor to detainees at the local ICE processing center. I was involved with that ministry for several years, accompanying males and females of different nationalities while in detention. I think I visited, like, I don't know, probably 6 years. People from Central America, from Africa, both male and female. Through the same relationship, I was invited to participate, leading trauma and stress healing workshops as a volunteer with JRS's chaplaincy program at the same ICE processing center. I did that, and I really, really enjoyed doing that. But I did it right up to the time when the COVID-19 safety precautions prevented volunteers from entering the detention center in March 2020. Also, when groups of migrants started increasing in number here at the border in 2014 and up to the end of 2018, or probably 2019, beginning of 2019, I was a volunteer with the El Paso Annunciation House, working in their shelters as a shift coordinator and completing intake and transportation calls. So that's how I started working with migrants. Then, about my training in psychology and anthropology and how it impacts my work. I think that immigration is a complex issue. I'm not an expert on immigration, but the training in humanistic and social sciences that I have completed helps me in understanding the situation of people leaving their homes and traveling to an unknown destination with dreams of a better future. Education helps. It helps a lot. But it helps at the intellectual level. However, I think that what probably helps the most is that I was born, raised, and have lived in several Central American countries. I am originally from Guatemala, and I am familiar with the living circumstances that refugees leave behind in their home countries. As an immigrant myself, a Guatemalteca and an indigenous person, I can understand the agonizing decision of leaving everything behind and venturing into an unknown and uncertain future. That's why in my work I look for opportunities to engage with those we serve and talk with them. I do that because I think that talking about all the things that we have in common, like everyday expressions, mannerism, or even food, creates warmth and connections that are sustaining and develop trust. People connect through those little details. And that is the basis from where I start in supporting their emotional health. Although, of course, there is people who might need more specialized or long-term support, that initial connection, that being able to connect with someone who share experiences and cultures, who can understand them, who can offer empathy and a listening ear and heart, can go a long way to support their well-being. Because one of the worst effects of migrating to a new place is that sense of disconnection and isolation. And again, those little details help to connect. What is the U.S. border program, Caminar Contigo? Caminar Contigo is a binational and cross-border program that focuses on providing legal and mental health and psychosocial support to forcibly displaced individuals and asylum seekers in the Paso del Norte region of the border. That's kind of the traditional name of this region, and includes Ciudad Juárez, Chihuahua, Mexico, El Paso, and other neighboring Texas counties, as well as the southern New Mexico county of Doña Ana, and the city of Sonoma Park. El trabajo de Caminando Contigo, the work of Caminando Contigo started recently, and we're still early in its development. The newness of the program and the restrictions imposed by the global pandemic have limited our activities. Currently, we offer brief orientation to individuals who have started crossing to the United States after being stranded in Ciudad Juárez to the Migrant Protection Protocol, or MPP, or the Remain in Mexico, which is the other name for the same policy instituted by the previous administration. The orientation that is offered consists of welcoming them, kind of smiling and telling them welcome into the United States and see their faces all excited, making sure they have the I-94 form, which is a form that allows them to travel within the United States, and guiding them once they enter through the port of entry. There's literally a door. We're there at the door welcoming, and we guide them to local transportation, to shelters, or to bus stations or airports, or some families come and pick them up from that port of entry as well. Another service we have been offering is basic psychosocial and mental health support, as I mentioned before, kind of offering that support through connecting with them. These are individuals in shelters in Ciudad Juárez, of course, since we are still working remotely. The same service is offered to individuals crossing into the United States after staying in MPP, and we do that when this service is requested. These particular services upon entering or upon crossing is done in a more limited manner because the conditions are not optimal when they are crossing. We are right there on the street, and that's the limitation of the work. Other services we offer are demonstrations, like for staff in shelters, I have offered demonstrations. And I've shared supporting materials for mental health and psychosocial support. And this is done with the intention of offering capacity building resources. What a typical day look like. Right now the days vary from one to the other. Our legal specialist, an attorney, has been consistently at the port of entrances, aid, I'm sorry, at the port of entrance, aiding people who cross into the United States after MPP. I have joined him in a couple of occasions, and it really can be a very moving experience. I was there recently when a group of young Cuban males entered the U.S. They were joyful, all excited, smiling, jumping, as their ordeal in MPP in Ciudad Juárez ended. They had been, and most of the people in MPP, or many at least of the people in MPP, have been there over 2 years, and they have been through a lot. These individuals, this particular group of Cubans, when they enter, starting hugging themselves and high-fiving each other, and express how unbelievable for them it was to be in the US. I even observed one of them. I was up when he left the exit. He walked a little bit and I saw him on the street. He was walking and I saw him talking with himself, and then he knelt. He knelt on the street and touched the soil, and like he was kind of blessing himself. He touched the soil and then he kissed his hand that had just touched the soil. I had the opportunity of talking more in detail with one of them, and this particular person, he shared with me how he arrived in Ciudad Juárez, and after a couple of weeks he registered in the list of MPP. He said that at the time he registered, there were thousands of people already in the metering list. And he told me, and I could just imagine how terrible it was. He told me that every day he kept track of the counting. And he said his number was in the 17,000s. So he gave me his exact number. I'm not sharing it, of course, right now, but it was like, I can imagine just counting every single number of those waiting for him to be called. So this man talked about the culture of shock, the isolation he experienced. And he said that because he didn't even talk in public, because he of his fear, he of being identified due to his accent and being kidnapped or extorted. He mentioned how in Cuba he could fear the police harassing him, but he had never experienced a shootout or assassination or the extortion that he experienced in Ciudad Juárez. He asserted that Cubans are a target for the police in Ciudad Juárez, where they threaten to arrest and deport him. So you're asking me about success for Caminar Contigo. I think that more than thinking of the success of a program, I believe that we should focus on success for the people that we serve. Because people sometimes equate big numbers with success, and it's not necessarily the case for the program. I mean, we can offer numbers, we can offer quantitative data, but I think that success can be measured in a different way. For example, I recently worked with a young Brazilian couple. As I said before, they remained in Mexico for almost 2 years. But when COVID arrived, it forced them into a permanent stay in a local shelter. They weren't allowed to leave at all. So the tedium of every day, the limited space, the inability to socialize, the lack of privacy, or the inability to work, and in general, the overall uncertainty of their situation was placing a heavy burden on them as individuals and as a couple. So the young husband was the one having the most difficulty in dealing with the circumstances. So I had the opportunity of talking with him once, but could not follow up because of unexpected changes in policy and people starting to register and organize across. So it was impossible to reconnect. I tried, but I couldn't. So, but as a mere coincidence, I was at the port of entry on unrelated business when this couple happened to enter the United States. My surprise was big, but my satisfaction was greater when, after approaching and greeting them, he looked at me and said, "You, I recognize you from your voice," and he proceeded to give me a hug. And he expressed how talking with me had helped him to understand the situation and to understand his wife, and that helped to solve their conflicts. "I am so grateful," he said. He was wearing a mask, but his eye and his, I don't know, his body language showed genuine happiness, and that made me happy as well. I mean, I have training and experience, but it was not a complicated thing what I did. It was not a complicated thing what I did. Yet, as I said before, taking the time to listen and explain and help him reflect and understand, it didn't take much time, didn't cause big waves, but enabled this man to bear a little longer the real dire circumstances in which he found himself. To me, that is success. His success in maintaining the hope and enduring hardship to achieve the goal that brought him and his family to this country. I mean, it cannot be counted in number, but I think it's success. So, how can our readers support the program or asylum seekers? Obviously, any program or initiative requires financial support. And we would be very appreciative of any donation you can do to the program, to Caminando Contigo. For JRIS and this new program serving vulnerable individuals seeking protection at the US-Mexico border, I believe it is very important to be informed in order to advocate for them. Because there is a lot of misinformation going around portraying these vulnerable groups in a very negative light, and I think that's unfair and it doesn't help. Being informed about what is happening in the countries of origin that forces them to flee, understanding the difficult decisions they are forced to make, seeking ways to support them in their destination, that would support our program. Our program, and more importantly, will contribute to provide these individuals with a better chance to achieve their aspirations for a better life.